Welcome to the podcast where heavy industrial industries meet the venture capital ecosystem, interviewing both thought-leading investors and pioneering founders to better understand the opportunities and challenges that lie ahead for digital industrial innovation. Your host is Ty Finley, and this is the Heavy Hitters Podcast.
Leo Polovitz joins us today from Miami. Leo is a GP at Humba Ventures, where he focused on deep tech and American dynamism, pre-seed and seed companies based in the U.S. and Canada. He's also a GP and co-founder at SUSE Ventures that we'll discuss more later how SUSE and Humba relate. And prior to jumping into venture capital, he was a software engineer at LinkedIn, Google, and Factual. Some of his investments aligned to our audience today include Dusty Robotics, Placer, Veho, amongst many others. Leo, I'm glad I'm catching you before the madness that's upcoming for Miami Tech Week, and we're long overdue to highlight what you're building here at Humba Ventures on the show. So thanks for joining, and welcome to the Heavy Hitters.
Thanks, Ty. Really excited to be here and to chat today.
Right on. Well, we always start, same thing, give a little snippet of someone's background, but definitely give us more of that color commentary on your journey from being a software engineer into venture capital, and where you sit today investing out of SUSE and Humba Ventures.
Yeah, absolutely. So as you mentioned, you know, I've been technical for most of my life. Like, I went to Caltech for undergrad, graduated with a computer science degree, and then was a software engineer for about a decade. And I got pretty lucky. Actually, basically my first job out of college is I joined LinkedIn when they were just starting out. The company was about a dozen people, and I joined because I knew one of the co-founders and worked there for a couple of years. Then after that, I went to Google, and then I went to another startup called Factual that was roughly the same size as LinkedIn when I joined. So it was about 15 people. And so I really enjoyed the startup experiences. About 10, 11 years ago, I was actually thinking maybe I wanted to start a company, but you know, I felt like I kept seeing the Series A phase and I'd never seen seed or inception. And I wanted to learn a little bit more about that. And I had a couple of friends that were angel investing and thinking of starting a fund, and they invited me to join them as an angel, you know, just to like help them with tech due diligence, look at companies, meet founders. And I thought that would be a great way to, you know, learn about how investors think, maybe learn some of the lessons that seed stage companies learn the hard way. And then I go start a company in a year or two. And instead, I ended up really liking venture. My friends and I ended up founding this firm called SUSE Ventures back in 2013, which is now a pretty mature fund. It's with the tail end of our fourth fund. We're usually writing $2 million checks at seed stage in sectors like SaaS and fintech and healthcare, and back companies like Robinhood and Flexport over the years. And then, you know, a few years ago, being technical, like I've always been interested in the more technical, like deep techy companies. And so started a sister fund called Humba Ventures back in 2021. And I've been really focusing most of my time on that for the last 2.5 years. And that fund really invests, as you mentioned, in deep tech, American dynamism, you know, these sectors like manufacturing and robotics and space and you name it. And that's been a lot of fun to work on for the last couple of years.
Right on. Well, we'll take more focus on American dynamism and all that want to join. So excited to have Humba deep in the weeds already investing, clearly. And so maybe just so we could set that stage a little bit for the listeners who maybe aren't as familiar, but SUSE Ventures, Humba Ventures, how do the funds fit together? Maybe a little bit more detail there. And just maybe from the mandate on Humba Ventures specifically, stage, check size, just so everyone has that on record if they're wanting to reach out.
Yeah, so the funds are both early stage, so they generally focus on pre-seed and seed. And then the place where they diverge is sector focus. So SUSE is really focused on traditional tech. So the main focus areas for us have been SaaS, enterprise SaaS, fintech, healthcare, supply chain, and developer tools. And then Humba is, you know, essentially it's focused on almost everything else. So instead of traditional tech, it's deep tech. So this will be things with like hardware, biology, you know, like things going up into space, defense. A lot of these sectors have been more overlooked by VCs. You know, so there's a few folks like you investing here and have been doing it for years, but there's not that many VCs here compared to the traditional side. And that's part of what attracted me to this area. But also, I think just these companies have really interesting potential. Like they're, you know, just really fun to work with and like really interesting ideas in terms of like technical innovation. And so the funds basically are similar in terms of stage. They're very different in terms of sectors. And then the check sizes for Humba, because it's a younger fund, are a little bit smaller. So SUSE tends to write checks that are around $2 million. Humba is usually in the like $500,000-$600,000 range, although the checks can go down about $250,000 and up to about $1 million.
Excellent. Okay. And you helped lead us into the next question already, a little bit of a teaser there, but let's go deeper on Humba here. And as it's most aligned to the focus of this podcast, of course, digital industrial as we call it, but let's go deeper into the why and how that thought process started within SUSE and you, which obviously SUSE has been a well-known generalist fund for more than a decade. That why to decide to launch Humba, and I use in quote, a new fund that's mainly focused on smaller emerging sectors and technologies like robotics and manufacturing, climate and energy, and defense and security. You summarize as deep tech and Americanism. So maybe just a little bit color deeper on the why do this.
Yeah, so maybe if you want later, we can talk about like why I think these sectors specifically are interesting.
Yeah.
But in terms of why it's separate funds, you know, I'd say like the simple answer is like, you know, we tell founders or we suggest to founders that they focus all the time of like, you know, don't do three things under one company, do like one thing really well. Mm-hmm. And we felt like that should apply to funds as well. And you see this sometimes with larger funds where, you know, it's like a $500 million fund and they have, you know, series A and B large checks in there and seed checks and like, you know, a little test bed for like deep tech or some other sector. And I think to a founder, it's like, it's not really clear, like, what is that fund really focused on? And usually like just one of those strategies ends up dominating the fund's returns, right? So for example, maybe it's a $500 million fund and like 350 or 400 million goes into series A and B checks. It almost doesn't matter what the other stuff you do is because like the fund's returns will be just based on how your series A and B investments do. Mm. And then I think that just creates weird incentives, right? Because like, for example, whoever's writing the, you know, the deep tech testing checks or like pilot checks, like they have zero impact on the fund in practice. And so we didn't really like that kind of setup. We felt like each fund should have an investment team that's really focused on that strategy. And maybe those investment teams are different, right? So maybe the investors you want for the Series A and B opportunity fund are different than the ones you want doing like lead checks and board seats for SaaS. And that's different than who you want doing like a pre-seed check in a robotics company. So basically what we have is we have three GPs on the team. And each of the GPs manages one of our three funds. So we have SUSE and Humba. And then we have our opportunity fund that's a little bit later stage called Kibu. And each GP can build the right investing team just in terms of the experience they're looking for, both the investing side or the operating and support side. And also, we think it's like easier to create a brand for founders and like a clear message for founders where, again, it's not a giant fund with a bunch of commingled strategies and it's not really clear what it stands for or like how much it focuses on your area. But instead, each fund is, you know, really dedicated to like the founders at the stage and sectors that it serves. So for Humba, for example, you know, I've done about 24 investments over the last 2.5 years, and they're all in these spaces. And so it's not, you know, you don't look at the portfolio and go like, hey, it looks like a normal fund that will do deep tech once in a while. It really looks like a fund that just does deep tech and American dynamism, which is what it is.
Right. Yeah. And Leo is not a new brand, but Humba, and you've done a great job. And we'll talk about some of the content you've put out branding Humba. And as a sector focused VC myself, I do think that specialization matters to founders. And I think it's a great move. And we're going to come back to you have been a great cheerleader for what we all know. Deep tech is an amazing place to be putting investment now. But before we get there, real quick sub question to the point of investing out of Humba, different than investing out of SUSE, a little bit of a setup there. You know, given that these sectors, they do look a lot different sometimes and call it pure B2B SaaS or consumer, however we want to define it. Yeah, do you conduct diligence differently at all or follow a different playbook for the investment process out of Humba than you did at SUSE? Maybe just a little color there on any differences y'all have.
Yeah, it's a great question. I think there's two main differences. So one is I think at Humba, I'm even more founder-oriented. You know, on the traditional tech side, like let's say for enterprise SaaS, I think it's taken for granted that, you know, things can be easier or harder to build, but most good engineers can build most products that you'd want in that side of the world. On the deep tech side, it's not the case. You usually need some kind of, you know, very specific experience. Like maybe you need to understand hardware or firmware or how things work in space, or like you need to know biology. So that's on the technical side, but also a lot of times you're trying to sell into an industry that's pretty hard to penetrate, right? So like if you're selling to oil and gas, you know, that's not just something where you can have an SDR call 100 oil and gas companies every day and get a bunch of leads. Like, yeah. So the industry doesn't work that way. So I think from that perspective, really look more for founding teams where, you know, maybe there's two or three or four buckets of expertise that the ideal team would have to build whatever they're building. And so ideally you want the founding team to, you know, check the boxes on those two or three or four buckets. So I think that's one piece is just like spending a lot more time on the founders and how do they fit the specific idea they're working on. Yep. And are there any gaps in the founding team? And then the other side is, you know, as I mentioned, I think most traditional tech products are like fairly buildable by good engineers. That's not quite the case on deep tech. So a lot of times there is a lot more technical risk. There's maybe even science risk. And so you really want a team that's, you know, world-class on the technical aspects of whatever they're building so that, you know, you do feel like, hey, very few people can build this, but like this team can.
Excellent. Well, two great pieces of feedback. And so maybe we'll take all of that forward, getting back to the point of, well, why put all the focus, the brand, those specific things I'm looking for into this Humba Ventures effort. So regardless of strategy, approach, et cetera, you're clearly bullish on this thesis. And you wrote a great piece of content on your blog late last year, I think, in quote, that deep tech is the best place to be investing and building right now. I love the clarity of thought there. And I think we've certainly continued to see some monster fundraising announcements aligned to this sector just over the last month alone. It's been quite impressive to see, even though the fundraising dynamics are still at play in a lot of ways. So that's it. In the content, you go on to take on what you cite as four assumptions about deep tech companies that turn out to be misconceptions. So we got to hit on this. Talk us through why you're all in on deep tech, however you define it, and why you felt it was important to come out with a content piece that uses data, really good data, to tackle these commonly held ideas that you believe can be proven wrong. Because we're recruiting other investors and founders all the time. I think this is great. Let's jump into it.
I think if you ask 10 different investors on in deep tech what it means to them, you probably get slightly different answers.
Never. Slightly is the conservative way to say it, for sure. So go for it, then, Leo. We're looking for yours.
The other nine are wrong, so here's my answer.
That's true.
So I think the key thing for me is that there's, you know, serious science or engineering risk. So basically, like, you can't take for granted that whatever the company wants to build is just very buildable. And so there's something they have to prove out, either in terms of, like, again, heavy engineering risk, maybe integrating a lot of complex systems, or science risk, where you have to actually make some kind of, you know, small or large scientific breakthrough. So to me, deep tech, basically, like, that's the main criteria, that, like, you can't, you know, it's not a sure thing that the product that the company wants to build can be built. And so what you're really betting on is, like, this team will figure it out somehow, even though it's uncertain.
Pretty clear line. I like it.
Yeah. Thank you. So I would say there's a bunch of reasons I'm all in. I think maybe to highlight three, I think one is there's really good macro tailwinds right now. So, you know, for example, like, we have a lot of global conflict. So that's, you know, very, very unfortunate. And I hope it goes away. But it's also creating a lot more pressure for us to innovate a lot with, like, military technologies and, you know, be more prepared, have better deterrence, things like that. Or, you know, for something like manufacturing, like, we have tension with China right now. And so I think a lot of companies are worried about, you know, can I depend on China for manufacturing or for raw materials? And these companies that maybe 5, 10, 20 years ago were very happy with the status quo. And, you know, even if you pitched them some kind of automation solution or different material or something like that, like, they just wouldn't care. Now there's this really nice opening where those companies are very willing to look at alternatives because they're worried about, you know, the status quo going away. So I do think you have these tailwinds that create interesting opportunities for startups that maybe weren't as clear or as strong 5 or 10 years ago. That's one piece. I think related to that, the funding risk is a lot lower for companies, especially at later stages. So one of the reasons we never invested in these categories much at SUSE over the last 10, 11 years is that when we started, like, 10 years ago, there weren't a lot of Series A investors or Series B investors in these spaces. And so it was very likely that, you know, you could start, like, let's say, a material science company. And even if you raise a seed round, you know, by the time you want to raise a Series A, there was, like, a short list of 3 or 4 investors that would do a Series A in a, you know, material science company with some kind of, like, physical experimentation platform. And if you couldn't get those 3 or 4 investors on board, like, that was it. You're out of money. And I think now, you know, because of these tailwinds and because people are starting to see better and better returns on the deep tech side, you have a lot of later stage funds now doing Series A's and Series B's very willingly and readily. And so I think that's exciting because it takes some of the funding risk off the table. Mm-hmm. And then I think the last thing I'm excited about here, and or the last thing I'll talk about, there's a bunch more I'm excited about, but I think there's much more potential to dominate a market. These companies are much harder to start. You know, like, you do need the right team. You do need some kind of technological breakthrough. But because of that barrier to entry being higher, you usually end up competing with, you know, 0 or 2 or 5 companies as you get big, and not, you know, 50 or 500 companies. As you might in, let's say, like, enterprise SaaS. And that has a lot of advantages because when you compete with 50 companies, it's not just that it's much harder to be number one. It's actually, like, much harder to even just stand out in the first place because your customers are getting inundated by, like, you know, 49 other competitors. But if it's just you and like one or two other players, you know, you have a good chance of being first. If you're not first, you could probably be second or third. And so I think the opportunities end up being bigger, where once you overcome that burden of like building something really hard to build, you get rewarded for it much more handsomely. So I think that's really exciting too.
Yeah, go ahead, sir.
Oh, sorry, I was gonna say, so in terms of the misconceptions you mentioned, so I have had like other VCs and LPs often ask me about, you know, do I think these areas are worth investing in? Like, aren't they capital intensive? Aren't the exits poor? And, you know, my belief very much was that like those were misconceptions and they weren't correct. But I think like people can believe anything they want. I wanted to try to prove it. And so being an engineer, I decided to look at the data. And I looked at things like, you know, do deep tech companies have poor outcomes, or are they more capital intensive, or, you know, do they fail at much higher rates? And I generally found that those things were not true. I think, you know, part of the misconception in my mind is that there's just generally been fewer deep tech companies over the last 10, 20 years. And so all of the examples we think of are traditional tech, you know. And so what happens is, like, you know, there's 100 deep tech companies and five are really successful. And then there's like a million SaaS companies and 500 are successful. And so the odds of success are much better in deep tech, but all the examples we can think of are like, you know, in traditional tech. And I think that'll, you know, that those things will kind of converge a bit more over time. I think we'll see a lot more successful deep tech companies over the next decade. But I think in my mind, that's where a lot of the misconceptions come from.
Yeah, and maybe just to pull one of the misconceptions out, because I'm in the camp with you. It's always, you know, you and I will have our spreadsheet of where the big exits have come out and defending the thesis across different sectors or markets that we focus on. So maybe for that misconception specifically, that deep tech companies have poor outcomes, as you defined, as I think the first of the four. You know, any other, like, what data did you find? Or maybe let's go zoom in there, if you would, on what you found out of you doing your homework on that to defend it. Because we're always, you know, whether it's co-investors or even limited partners into our funds, this one always comes up. So I'm curious if there was anything that you could share a little deeper on that one.
Yeah, I mean, I think so maybe to reframe it a little bit, I think the thing that investors care about, and I think a lot of times what like ambitious founders care about, is maybe less the risk of failure and more like what are the odds of like a good success, right? And so, you know, I think for most ambitious founders, they don't want something that, you know, never dies but never gets big. I think they kind of prefer either like a quick, you know, quick failure or like a long-term very big success.
Right.
And so the thing I tried to look at is like, well, how many big successes are there? And what I did is there's this nice database of venture capital deal data called PitchBook. And so I looked at that, this is 6 months ago, so I might be misremembering, but, you know, I looked at some of their data on seed rounds and exits over the last couple of decades. And I basically looked at like, well, how many companies were there that raised, you know, a seed round in a given space? And then how many of them, you know, ended up having a decent exit, where decent was, you know, let's say $250 million plus or $500 million plus.
Sure.
Where I think that's pretty sizable, where both the founders very happy and the investors are generally very happy. And then I looked at across these sectors, like, you know, SaaS, fintech, but also like life science and robotics and defense, and basically just tried to get that ratio of like, what's the ratio of companies that have good exits among the ones that actually raise a seed round? And I might be misremembering, but I think on SaaS, it was something like 1 or 1.5% of companies that raise a seed round had like a $250 million plus exit. And I think for a lot of deep tech sectors, it tend to be more like 3, 4, 5%. And so just directionally, I think the numbers are quite good in favor of deep tech. And that was the data analysis I did for that.
Excellent. Well, I think we could do a lot more of it and share a lot of that data like you did in your blog, because I think, again, like you've articulated, big opportunity. You got to know how to approach it. You got to know the right team DNA to approach it with. And then there is a capitalization strategy we won't have time to go deep into that does associate itself. Doesn't mean it always has to be massive CapEx, means massive rounds. So lots of nuance there. But I'm glad more and more folks are trying to put data out there to dispel a lot of it.
Absolutely. And actually, if I can add on to that really quickly on the capitalization piece, I think this is probably the assumption that, you know, is the hardest to shake, which is like these companies are very capital intensive. And I think it's hard to appreciate without talking to a lot of founders, like just how much startup costs have fallen in some of these areas, you know, because we think about like, well, you used to have, you know, for like SaaS, you used to have to buy a server rack and put it, you know, in some colo like 10 miles down the street. And it was very expensive. You had to raise, you know, $5 or $10 million just to get going. And then AWS came and you could do this stuff for, you know, like basically like per hour instead of with $10 million up front. and we've had these other things like Moore's Law and software that's made it a lot cheaper to, you know, to get going and like get enough compute and like do interesting things. But that exists on the deep tech side as well. So like the cost of, you know, sequencing genomes is down like, I don't know, 10,000x in 10 years or something like that. And the cost to send a satellite up into space, like per kilogram, is down, I don't know, like 100-fold in 20 years. And so there's all these things where like, it's true that, you know, 20 years ago, if you wanted to do a gene sequencing startup or like something with satellites, you probably did need to raise 10 or 20 million and maybe 100 million just to get going. But today, like you have pre-seed companies that launch things into space. And so I think that's probably the other interesting thing to keep track of here is like, you do need a good team. You do need a lot of specialized expertise, but also just the startup costs keep going down in these areas, just like they did in software over the last couple of decades.
Yeah. And I think just the last thing I'd add onto that too, the maturity of building, if there's a hardware component involved, the maturity of the information out there about, you know, call it at the unit economic level, how do you build responsibly with hardware involved as a part of the solution? On this podcast, we've referenced several times Silicon Valley Bank and other partners. They put out, I think it was called the State of Hardware Report. And I believe they're about to put a refreshed version out of it from my recent chats. But it goes into great detail of how to build a P&L and how to be thoughtful of metrics and burn around how you scale a hardware product within a company, right? Because there's customer acquisition costs generally. There's also hardware acquisition costs and how do you amortize it and depreciate it and all the nuance that goes with it. So I ramble on to just say the maturity curve of how you build a business with hardware, not only is it cheaper to do, like you mentioned, but there's also a lot more information out there than it ever's been. So we'll keep promoting as best we can, Leo. I know we will. So.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, zooming out a little bit, this is always a crowd favorite question. And because of the mandate you have at home, but I got to go here. We got a lot of listeners that are interested in seeing what is hot in terms of leading trends or areas that are having more, call it faster commercial adoption than others, especially aligned to what both of you and I focus on. So in a section I like to call what's hot and what's hype, you know, tell us what technologies or business model approaches are hot to you right now and maybe proven to be deployed at scale versus what areas of innovation we all know are promising, but, you know, to use that Gartner term, we're overhyped at least for now and wherever that wavy curve thing it is. So would love to hear what's hot and what's hype for you.
Yeah, I mean, I would say like I do think it's important to track hype. I tend to think that like even in hyped areas, you can build really interesting things. So like, you know, maybe some of the areas I've seen a lot of activity in recently are, you know, software for manufacturing in terms of like documentation and work instructions and, you know, getting grants in areas like climate or defense. And, you know, I think there's a lot of activity in those spaces, but also I think there's a lot of value to be created. So, I'm sure there'll be some big companies emerging there. Mm-hmm. I'd say a couple of the areas that are emerging that I'm really excited about, you know, maybe two I'll flag are robotics and space infrastructure. So on the robotics side and like the manufacturing side, I think the technology is just getting better very rapidly. Like 3D printing is getting better. I think robot software is getting much better. It's almost having, you know, I feel like it's on the verge of its own like ChatGPT type of moment.
Sure.
Where you're going from, you know, it takes a lot of coding and training to have, you know, get a robot to do a specific task to like, maybe you just show it a few visual examples and it can do it, you know, better than you. So I think that's a really exciting area. And then on the space infrastructure side, now that we're just sending up more and more stuff into space, and then I think in a couple of years when Starship's live and, you know, shuttling stuff back and forth, like I think space is just going to continue to explode in terms of the amount of activity there. And then as that happens, it's not hard to imagine that you just need much better infrastructure that maybe even starts to mirror like some of the things we have on Earth. Like we have an energy grid on Earth, like there's not one up in space that I know of. Or, you know, we need like better ground stations and we have an investment there in a company called Northwood Space, but basically like handle all of the like extra data coming in that, you know, the current ground station network isn't well equipped for. Or maybe it's like transporting things, you know, like shuttling things between satellites. Again, like there's all these things that, you know, here we have like trucks and PG&E and, you know, like energy companies, and we don't have that up there, but I think we will over the next 5, 10, 15 years. So I think it's an exciting time to invest in that area and to build another area.
And Starship and many others included, the infrastructure is now laid to really start thinking about what's next with all of those massive, when was the Starship? Was it 2 weeks ago that he put the second one up? It's just amazing to think what's all going to be up there. So if you're going to build the grid up there, Leo, just make sure you bring me with you. I'm excited to see it. So, well, pushing us forward here, we do always want to bring this show back to the founders, those folks actually in the arena, as we all see on Twitter. But we want to bring it back to them. We want to give them words of wisdom. If they're out there thinking about raising venture capital in 2024 or engaging SUSE or Humba. So maybe some thoughts from you. We'd like to split it. Any kind of key to success at the end of the chat or a common challenge to avoid as they approach?
Yeah, I mean, maybe a couple kind of keys to success and challenges I can think of. So I think one is, you know, you mentioned capitalization strategies earlier. I think these are important. You want to have basically meaningful milestones you can prove out between rounds. Because if you don't quite hit a milestone, like you don't really get credit for it in the next round, because your company looks, you know, largely how it did, you know, when you raise the current round. So you want to have a plan where, you know, the idea is like you raise at some price today, let's say it's X dollars. You want a plan where the things you prove out with the money you raise can get your valuation up to like 3X or 4X or something like that. And I think that's really important because sometimes I'll, you know, you talk to a company and they're like, well, we need, you know, $5 million to like, to do this important thing, but we're not sure if we can raise five, so we're gonna raise like three or four. And like, I think that's actually like a pretty painful plan to go through because you raise three or four, but it doesn't help you get to your goals. And then when you wanna raise next time, people are like, well, you didn't hit any goals, so like, why would I fund your company? So I do think like, thinking about that capitalization plan, how much do you really need? What can you do with it? Is what you can do with it meaningful? I think that's really important. And then I would say like two other tips are like one, manage burn carefully. I think this is kind of related. I think it's easy to overhire, especially when you just raised a round and you kind of finally have some money in the bank. And, you know, if you hire people that you need that, you know, you can't avoid that. But a lot of times, you know, people hire preemptively or they're not even sure they need them. They just feel like, well, I have money in the bank. Let me grow the team. And that's usually a recipe for just running out of money quickly. And then, you know, kind of related to that point, I would say like the other tip that I think early stage founders struggle with the most is letting people go. You know, because not every hire you make will be perfect. And actually, like one of the more interesting pieces of advice on this I've heard is, or like observations I've heard is basically like, if you never fire somebody, you don't have an A+ team, which kind of makes sense, right? Because it's like, well, if your hiring is not perfect, occasionally you hire like a B+ or maybe a D+. And if you never let people go, your team's not going to be all A+s. There's going to be some B or C or D players there. So like, don't be afraid to just acknowledge like, hey, maybe this isn't the right person for me. Like part with them in like an amicable way and like a way that, you know, treats them with respect. But don't just keep people on just because you're afraid of firing people.
Yeah. Fast moving environments, lots changing. I think long ago, right, Ben put in his book, The Hard Thing About Hard Things, is you're hiring for 18 months and then we got to figure out what you need after that. Right. Yep. So lots of nuance there. Excellent. Well, we will wrap up here. A little section we call quick hitters, a little bit of a Q&A. So if you're ready to jump in, we'll get going.
Sure. Absolutely.
All right. Number one thing you're looking for when you're evaluating a founder building within this ecosystem.
I think this probably won't be a surprise given the start of this podcast, but I think founder market fit is the biggest one of just whatever you're building. Are you the right founding team or the ideal founding team to build it? And then probably kind of second of that is just, you know, a lot of like ambition and grit, because those are really required to build a huge company.
Yeah, the founder market fit is just key. You definitely got to build tech and product, but the domain experience, or at least how you're augmenting that into the team for these industries, mission critical, oil and gas aside, as we talked about earlier. So agree. What's one resource? Could be a book, podcast, blog you'd recommend for our audience to follow in this ecosystem.
So I'm going to cheat. I don't have a concrete recommendation. I would say like Twitter is probably the best place still. But I think there's not a specific resource because like deep tech is so broad, right? It covers like building bioreactors or, you know, putting stuff into space or building like, you know, like 3D printers. I don't know if there's one resource that really captures that other than something like Twitter. So like if you have a specific area you're interested in, you know, there's newsletters and podcasts and things on like, you know, nuclear and manufacturing, all this stuff. So you should subscribe to those. But if you just want like a good generalist place to talk to interesting people, to see what interesting people in the sector you like are saying, like, I think Twitter can't be beat.
Yeah. High velocity information there. Absolutely. Well then next, as we start to continue to cheerlead and bring more folks into the fold here, who's a person that should be on the podcast? Help us keep waving the flag.
man, there's so many people I could list. Maybe one I'll highlight that I think is still under the radar, starting to like pop up a bit more, and that I really like is Mike Annunziata, who's got a new fund called Also Capital. I think he's great.
Awesome. Yeah, more and more jumping in. And then finally, best way for folks to reach out to you after the show, Leo.
Yeah, so I am L Polovets on Twitter, LPOLOVETS. And then I have, I can be emailed. So I'm Leo at humbaventures.com. It's H-U-M-B-A Ventures.
Right on. Well, whether it was Sousa or now Humba in the new brand, it's great ally out here looking for lots of stuff to team up on. And we got a lot of work ahead of us for all of those macro reasons you mentioned earlier. It's obviously challenges. We talk about that, but big, big opportunities for all of us to go tackle as well. So I know you're game for it, Leo. Thanks for jumping on.
Thanks, Ty. It was a pleasure to be here.